Now, from the WMAL WinBet Studios, the Saturday Morning Update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler, Jeff Wolf behind the console this morning. Steve Bannon, longtime ally of former President Trump, has been indicted on two counts of criminal contempt of Congress. He has defied a subpoena from the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. And that is just one of the stories we are following this morning. We'll get into a lot of detail with John Gizzi, of course, the White House correspondent at Newsmax. We'll get into more detail with John on that later on this morning. But on Friday, the Justice Department did say that Steve Bannon was indicted on one count for refusing to appear for a deposition last month, the other for refusing to provide documents in response to the committee's subpoena. Bannon is expected to surrender to authorities on Monday, will appear in court on Monday afternoon. That word from a law enforcement official to the Associated Press, and of course, that person granted anonymity to discuss the case. The Attorney General Merrick Garland said that Bannon's indictment reflects the Justice Department's steadfast commitment to the rule of law. Each count carries a minimum of 30 days in jail and as long as a year behind bars. Now, part of the reason that the committee is so interested in Steve Bannon are some comments that he made on the War Room podcast, and this was on January 5th, the day before the insurrection at the Capitol.
All hell is going to break loose tomorrow. Just understand this. All hell is going to break loose tomorrow. It's not going to happen like you think it's going to happen, okay? It's going to be quite extraordinarily different. And all I can say is strap in. The War Room, a posse, you have made this happen, and tomorrow it's game day. So strap in.
And that's what the House committee wants to know a little more about, as well as other relationships that Steve Bannon has to January 6th. You may have seen some of the trial, maybe more of the testimony this week in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And they have rested the case. There will be final arguments on Monday. We're going to spend quite a bit of time with Jim Trusty, who will be analyzing that for us. Of course, he is our legal expert. You've seen him a lot on Fox this week. And we'll get into it with Jim, get more details. But if you missed some of the fireworks in the court this week, strange tactics used by the prosecution in the case. And some people, some of the pundits are saying the prosecution's case had been going so poorly that maybe the prosecutor was really going out there in order to get a mistrial. And some of the back and forth with the judge in the case was pretty amazing. And here's just an example.
I indicated a bias towards denial is what I did. Held it open with a bias toward denial. Why would you think that that made it okay for you, without any advance notice, to bring this matter before the jury? I was astonished when you began your examination by commenting on the defendant's post-arrest silence. That's basic law. It's been basic law in this country for 40 years, 50 years. I have no idea why you would do something like that. And it gives, I'll leave it at that. So I don't know what you're up to.
Well, that wasn't the only time the judge scolded the prosecutor.
I had heard nothing in this trial to change any of my rulings. So why?
Testimony, Your Honor.
Pardon me?
That was before the
defense
testimony.
Don't get brazen with me. You knew very well. You know very well that an attorney can't go into these types of areas when the judge has already ruled without asking outside the presence of the jury to do so. So don't give me that.
Wow, pretty intense. Well, it's also been intense in the media, and you have heard the attacks on Kyle Rittenhouse, people calling him a white supremacist, even going back as far as Joe Biden when he was a presidential candidate, calling Kyle Rittenhouse a white supremacist. He's been called a lot of things by the media pundits this week. And Kyle Rittenhouse's mom was on the Fox News Channel, and this is how she felt about what presidential candidate Joe Biden said about her son.
I was angry. President Biden don't know my son whatsoever, and he's not a white supremacist. He's not a racist. And he did that for the votes, and I was so angry for a while at him. And what he did to my son, he defamed him.
Well, we're going to see and hear a lot more about this. Again, closing arguments expected on Monday. The Wisconsin National Guard, 500 troops are on standby in Kenosha, Wisconsin for the outcome of that trial when the verdict is read. I'm thinking of starting a new feature on the program each week. Dumb things coming out of the administration. And some of the things that have been said by prominent people in the administration, pretty amazing, and we're going to get to them next. But first, we're going to check the traffic and weather this morning.
Traveling on the Beltway's outer loop between the Georgetown Pike and the Dulles Toll Road, you're going to find very heavy volume there. Bumper-to-bumper traffic, that just due to volume at this time. Route 3 eastbound near Bloomsbury Road. We have all lanes closed and that for crash investigation. Mass Avenue, both northbound, southbound, shut down. Utility work, the issue there between 38th and 39th Street. Hungerford Drive in Rockville, northbound 355, no access from westbound Beers Mill. Coming past St. Mary's Church into the Mixing Bowl, you will have to proceed straight through the intersection and then do the workaround to get through. I'm Jim Lavinell from GarageDoorRepairs.com for WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
We'll have the chance for a few stray showers this morning, but then clearing out pretty quickly into the afternoon, becoming breezy at times. Temperatures today going to be a little bit on the cooler side into the mid and upper 50s. Later on tonight, clear and cool. Temperatures back into the 30s across region. A cold start to your Sunday. Will be partly sunny to mostly cloudy at times on your Sunday. The temperatures on the cooler side once again, with highs only into the lower 50s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
45 degrees in the nation's capital, 618 on the Saturday morning update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It is Veterans Day weekend on the Saturday morning update, and we'll be saluting veterans a little bit later on in the program with John Gizzi. And we lost a great veteran this week, Max Cleland, the senator from Georgia, and we'll talk more about that later on in the program. I want to turn, though, to some of our administration officials overseas just saying some really dumb things. I mean, John Kerry has been at this climate summit. How long have they been there? What, a week or more? I mean, what is that costing in terms of the environment and all these people gathered and the aircraft to fly them in? Whatever. But here's John Kerry, and he's asked, I think, a very fair question by a reporter about the child labor abuses in China. And, of course, Kerry is talking to the Chinese. Would he maybe bring up this issue of child labor?
How, in the several months of meetings behind the scenes with China, did you bring up some of those very contentious issues, such as the use of forced labor in Xinjiang for building solar panels?
That's not my lane here. That's my job is to be the climate guy.
Hey, I'm the climate guy, just like the cable guy. I'm John Kerry, the climate guy. I don't care about the kids. I don't care about child labor. Why would I worry about that? I'm the climate guy. That's after he kind of put the coal industry out of business. This is a gem.
By 2030 in the United States, we won't have coal. We will not have coal plants. By 2035, President Biden has set a target that we will be, in our power sector, carbon free.
Carbon free. All right. Just like that carbon free jet you fly around in. Speaking of carbon footprint, we have the Vice President, Kamala Harris, flown off to the border. Finally, Kamala Harris is going to do something about the border. The only problem is it's not the southern border. It's the border in Europe. It's the border crisis in Europe. So here's a gem from Simone Sanders. She is the vice president's spokesperson, okay? She's asked here about the polls.
I'm not focused on the polls. I'll let the pundits pontificate on that. The polls are a snapshot in time. And at this time, I am looking forward to touching down in Paris, France, but before that, taking a nap.
When the going gets tough, the tough take a nap. Can you imagine if one of Trump's spokespeople had said something like that? Oh, I'm looking forward to touching down in Paris, but as far as you reporters are concerned, I'm going to take a nap right now. Well, of course, Kamala Harris was in Paris, and here's Kamala Harris in France as she's addressing French scientists.
With us in government, we campaign with the plan. Uppercase T, uppercase P, the plan. And then the environment is such that we're expected to defend the plan.
I'm not sure where that came from. We're at 6:22. It's the Saturday morning update on WMAL. A lot to cover. We've got, of course, Jennifer Harper taking a look at some ever-tanking polls for the Biden administration. That's coming up shortly. Also, information on CPAC 22. I know a lot of people attend CPAC, and the tickets are starting to go on sale, and Jennifer's got an update for us on that this morning. We'll talk with Jim Trusty. We'll get into the details of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, the strategy of the prosecutors, the strategy of the defense to put Kyle Rittenhouse on the stand, and also what to expect next in that Kyle Rittenhouse trial in Kenosha, Wisconsin. We'll talk with Jim about that. John Gizzi will join us this morning, and he'll have more on the Steve Bannon indictment, and also there are threats to indict Mark Meadows if he does not cooperate with the House committee. Cheryl Atkinson is going to be coming up this morning. Interesting conversation on the legalization of marijuana and how states are legalizing it, but it's still against federal law. How does that happen? Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer is on the way. We're going to talk with him about the activities of Russia, the Russia-Ukraine border, the Russia-Belarus border, Russian troops assembling there. It's troubling to Western allies. We'll get Tony's read on that this morning, and then we'll get a read from KT McFarland on all of the foreign policy issues the Biden administration is facing, including that upcoming virtual summit that the president will hold with Chinese President Xi Jinping on Monday. It's all coming up right here on the Saturday Morning Update. It's the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL 626. I'm Rick Fowler. Thank you for being with us this morning. And we saw the images out of New York City in the summer of 2020 with the police cars being Molotov cocktailed, police officers being beaten, others being beaten, lots of fires being set, basic riots in New York City. Well, New Yorkers had enough of the Bill de Blasio approach. Mayor de Blasio out of office, of course, and a new mayor is in. The new sheriff in town is Eric Adams, the new mayor of New York. And he ran on pretty much a law and order type of an agenda. And this is how Eric Adams has addressed his victory and what he sees for New York moving forward.
New Yorkers are not going to live in fear. And we're not going to be intimidated by anyone. This city is not going to be a city of riots. It's not going to be a city of burning. This is going to be a city where we're going to be safe. We're going to have effective policing that's not heavy-handed. We're going to have the backs of our police officers, but we're going to hold them accountable. I said I was going to reinstitute an anti-gun unit, and I'm not backing away from that.
So that's the new mayor of New York, and sounds like he wants to restore security to citizens of New York. Sounds fairly reasonable. Well, it doesn't sound fairly reasonable to Hawk Newsom. And Hawk Newsom speaking for Black Lives Matter in New York and basically speaking in response to the plans of the New York mayor, Eric Adams.
If they think that they're going to go back to the old ways of policing, then we are going to take to the streets again. There will be riots, there will be fire, and there will be bloodshed.
So a threat there from Hawk Newsom, and it'll be unfortunately, I guess, interesting to see how things play out in New York, if that's the attitude of those who are not accepting the new initiatives of Mayor Eric Adams. We're at 6:28. This is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
In the news at this hour, a federal court has declined to lift its stay on the Biden administration's vaccine mandate for businesses with 100 or more workers. The New Orleans-based 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals had granted an emergency stay last Saturday of the requirement by the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration that those workers would be vaccinated by January 4th or face mask requirements and weekly tests. Lawyers for the Justice and Labor Departments filed a response Monday. It said stopping the mandate from taking effect will only prolong the COVID-19 pandemic. The appeals court rejected that argument yesterday. Steve Bannon, longtime ally to former President Trump, has been indicted on 2 counts of criminal contempt of Congress after he defied a subpoena for the House committee that's investigating the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. The Justice Department said Friday that Bannon was indicted on 1 count for refusing to appear for a deposition, the other for refusing to provide documents in response to the committee's subpoena. He is expected to appear in court on Monday. 6:34, time for a check of the traffic and weather, and Jim Lavin in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
Traveling on the inner loop between Route 50 and Route 202, very heavy delays there. Be very careful. Watch for the brake lights on the approach. Slow your roll. The outer loop of the Beltway, same deal there. Between 193 and 267 at the Dulles Toll Road, only the volume is the issue. No accident activity in the way. Route 3 eastbound at Salem Church Road. Still working to clear the accident and success. It is now gone. All lanes have been reopened. Eastbound Route 3 at Salem Church Road. Eastbound on Route 3 at Bloomsbury Road. Still working to clear the crash activity there. The accident blocking all of your lanes. I'm Jim Lavin, now from GarageDoorRepair.com. The WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
We'll have the chance for a few stray showers this morning, but then clearing out pretty quickly into the afternoon, becoming breezy at times. Temperatures today going to be a little bit on the cooler side into the mid and upper 50s. Later on tonight, clear and cool. Temperatures back into the 30s across region. A cold start to your Sunday. It'll be partly sunny to mostly cloudy at times on your Sunday. The temperatures on the cooler side once again, with highs only into the lower 50s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
45 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:35 on the Saturday Morning Update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It's the Saturday Morning Update. Glad you're with us today. And Jennifer Harper joins us each week. She writes Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning.
And good morning, Rick.
Each week goes by, and there are more missteps by members of the administration and the president. Americans seem to be waking up, paying a little more attention to the administration. What are you seeing in these trends in the polls?
Well, the polls are always busy, aren't they, Rick? We just can't get away from them. And, you know, quite often I tell people polls are a tool and not necessarily the truth. But, boy, we sure are getting a lot of very telling numbers about President Biden this week. And let's take a really quick look at a major poll from Suffolk University and USA Today. This is a 180-page poll. Think about that, and it talked all about politics and the White House and so forth, but let's just get to these meaty numbers. Here's what Americans in general have to say at this very moment. 66% say the country is on the wrong track. 64% hope that President Biden does not run for president again in 2024. 59% disapprove of the job he has done so far, and 20% say that the single most important thing that President Biden could do in the next 365 days is to resign, retire, or quit. This is, again, coming from a USA Today poll. And his possibility of quitting, that was at the top of a list of 23 other suggestions that people had to talk about for President Biden to do. So that's rather telling. But anyway, let's move right along. We're kind of a melancholy list here. Another 67% of voters, they disapprove of the job Mr. Biden has done on immigration. 60% condemn his economic policy. 57% disapprove of his foreign policy. And 50% feel the same way about his COVID-19 policy, kind of crummy all across the board. And half of them even fault Mr. Biden's performance on climate change. Oh, my goodness. And another surprise finding here, Rick, if Mr. Biden faced former President Donald Trump in 2024, the president was favored by 40%, and Mr. Trump had the support of 44%. Not much of a change there, but that is statistically significant, that extra 4%. And again, this is a USA Today poll of 1,000 registered U.S. voters, and it was released on Monday.
How about the mood of the public in general?
Yeah, well, let's keep going with those polls. Everybody can kind of guess that the mood is not so hot right now. And this one is coming from the Harvard University Center for American Political Studies and the Harris poll. That's a very old-time, long-standing poll here, but let's get right to it. 57% of the respondents say that the U.S. economy is weak, and only 24% say that their personal financial situation is improving at this time. 56% say the nation is on the wrong track. The Democratic Party has an approval rating of 38%. Republican Party is only a notch ahead of that at 39%. In this poll, Mr. Biden has an approval of 43%, but that is down from 62% in June, so kind of plummeting there. And the overall approval of the U.S. Congress right now, 31%. And just two more disconcerting findings about this, that people sort of wonder about this but don't talk about it, but here's a poll identifying it. 58% of the respondents think that Mr. Biden is showing he is too old to be president. That includes 90% of Republicans, and 27% of Democrats agree with that, and another 53% overall have doubts about his fitness for office. And that's according to the poll itself. Again, this is a Harvard University poll, and that includes 85% of Republicans and 16% of Democrats also. And just in a happy note, the U.S. military earns a favorability rating of 80%. The nation's police force have a 71% approval, and the FBI a 59% approval. And the poll says that these are the most favored government institutions.
So let's turn to the southern border. So the feds won't build the wall. Who's going to do it?
Gosh, I had to read this one twice, but there are a lot of private citizens who are stepping in to not only upkeep the border wall in their neighborhood, but also speak out about it. And this is a very interesting podcast that came from the Center for Immigration Studies. This is a nonpartisan research organization that's just always brimming with statistics and numbers and stuff. And according to Russell Johnson, they went down and interviewed this gentleman, and he is a fourth-generation cattle rancher in southern New Mexico. He lives and works on 8 miles of the U.S.-Mexico border on the same land that was occupied by his great-grandfather in 1918. This is what he has to say. Private citizens should not have to maintain an international boundary. That is coming from Russell Johnson, the cattle rancher we were just talking about. He had a conversation with the Center for Immigration Studies, and right now, they're tasked with not only establishing and maintaining this 8 miles of fencing in order to stop the arrival of illegal immigrants, but they say they are illegally crossing anyway by either climbing over the barriers or driving over them. So Mr. Johnson, that's our cattle rancher, he says it's very labor-intensive to keep up these fences. There's no compensation for that. It's all out of my pocket. He says also, we've been here for over 100 years. We've put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into this land. We don't think we ought to move. This is an issue that our government needs to get control of. Again, he's telling this to the Center for Immigration Studies. And this particular podcast is part of a series titled Life on the U.S.-Mexico Border, The Abandoned Americans. It's talking about those folks who've been there for as many decades as our cattle rancher, but in lots of other situations. If you're curious about this and other podcasts, you can go to CIS.org. Again, that's CIS.org. That's the Center for Immigration Studies. They take a very close look at these serious circumstances down there.
So we hear about the red states, the blue states, and we always hear the term the political landscape. You've got an article on that this week.
Well, you know, if you think they're just Republicans and independents and Democrats, the Pew Research Center has another idea for you, because they have establish what they're calling a roadmap to today's fractured political landscape, meaning they have determined through their polling that there are now 9 distinct partisan callings among Americans in general. They go right across the whole ideological spectrum. If you're curious about them, leaning farthest to the right, these are the new categories they're working with, are the faith and flag conservatives. They're followed by the committed conservatives, followed by the populist right and the ambivalent right. Now we have to go over to the way over to the other side, and at the very farthest left of this political gauge are the progressive left. They're the most liberal of all, according to Pew Research Center. In second place are the establishment liberals, the Democratic mainstays, and the outsider left. And smack in the middle, who can't make up their mind, them in the middle, are the stressed sideliners. And you have to look at some of the definitions here. They define the faith and flag conservatives as being deeply loyal to former President Donald Trump. They are intensely conservative in all realms. They are far more likely than all other typology groups to say that government policy should support religious values and that compromise in politics is selling out on what you believe in. Again, this is all coming from the Pew Research Center. If you're curious about it, it's called Beyond Red versus Blue, the Political Typology. You can find that at pew.org. That's P-E-W.org. It's even got a quiz if you want to determine which one of those particular designations you are. So that's your homework for today.
Lots of folks like to go to CPAC every year, the Conservative Political Action Conference. Tickets go pretty fast, don't they?
Well, if you're curious about CPAC, indeed they are up and running, and tickets are on sale now for CPAC. It doesn't take place until February 24th and 27th. It will be in Orlando, but pre-registration, that's Orlando, Florida, pre-registration is now open for this very signature event. It's beloved among a lot of folks, draws all those happy conservative warriors and people from different political and cultural callings and students and talk radio hosts and everything else. And according to their announcement, which came out on Thursday, once again, there is hope for America. That's what they're saying in their statement. And last Tuesday, conservatives made major strides winning in deep blue states. We must continue to push back against the negative, divisive, hate-filled, the anti-American agenda of the left. This is just in the announcement for CPAC 22. So this is actually the largest gathering of conservatives on the planet. If you want to find out, if you want to register, see the details that are available so far, very easy website to go to, conservative.org.
Jennifer Harper, inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Follow her on Twitter at Harper Bulletin. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Rick, and we'll see you soon.
6:46, Saturday morning update on WMAL. Jim Trusty coming up next. We'll get into the details of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. But first, it's Jim Lavin in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
Traveling on the inner loop between Route 50 and Route 202. Very heavy delays there. Be very careful. Watch for the brake lights on the approach. Slow your roll. The outer loop of the Beltway, same deal there. Between 193 and 267 at the Dulles Toll Road. Only the volume is the issue. No accident activity in your way. Route 3 eastbound at Salem Church Road. Still working to clear the accident and success. It is now gone. All lanes have been reopened eastbound Route 3 at Salem Church Road. Eastbound on Route 3 at Bloomsbury Road, still working to clear the crash activity there. The accident blocking all of your lanes. I'm Jim Lavin, now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL StormWatch 7 forecast.
We'll have the chance for a few stray showers this morning, but then clearing out pretty quickly into the afternoon, becoming breezy at times. Temperatures today going to be a little bit on the cooler side into the mid and upper 50s. Later on tonight, clear and cool. Temperatures back into the 30s across region. A cold start to your Sunday. Will be partly sunny to mostly cloudy at times on your Sunday. The temperatures on the cooler side once again, with highs only into the lower 50s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the StormWatch 7 Weather Center.
45 degrees in the nation's capital, 648, the Saturday morning update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It's the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. We're joined by Jim Trusty. He's a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington, the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice, and has been spending quite a bit of time on the Fox News Channel this week with analysis of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Jim, great to have you with us this morning.
Sure thing. Good morning.
Riveting testimony this week in the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse. He's charged in the shooting in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Two killed, one wounded. He's pleading not guilty, says it was self-defense. Jim, at week's end, where do things stand in the trial?
Sure. Well, both parties have rested their cases. The government put on their evidence. The defense put on their testimony, including Kyle Rittenhouse taking the witness stand. Yesterday was what they call a charging conference, which is typically like watching paint dry if you're not an attorney. But basically, it's deciding what jury instructions will be given when they get ready for closing argument on Monday morning. What was interesting about yesterday, just a quick aside on this, Rick, there was a real open issue of whether either party was going to ask for what are called lesser included offenses instructions. In other words, even though he's charged with things like first degree murder or what they call intentional murder and some other offenses, will they ask for lesser offenses, easier for the government to prove but less exposure for the defendant? And as it turns out, it was a real high-stakes game of poker. The government asked for lesser included across the board. The defense only agreed with a few, and that's where the judge is going to go. Now, the judge actually kind of signaled that if the defense objected and wanted to go all out on just – wanted to go all in on just the notion of the most serious crimes or not guilty, that he might have done that, but they blinked. And so there's going to be a variety of different instructions added into the mix from the indictment for that jury to consider.
One of the big questions of the week was, why did the defense put the defendant, Kyle Rittenhouse, on the stand? The pundits are saying that the prosecution had a very weak presentation, the case was falling apart, but the defense decided to go ahead and have Kyle Rittenhouse testify. Why do that?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's a couple of things. I mean, the first is to generate a self-defense claim under the law. You do have to put on some substantial evidence. Now, maybe they would have had that from just the videos that were taken, but that's one thing that favors the idea of calling him to the stand. I think they sat down with this kid and talked to him and felt that he would be a very earnest witness. And I have to tell you, I mean, everybody can judge credibility. It doesn't require, you know, any sort of experience in the criminal justice system. But I would just tell you, over my 27 years as a prosecutor, state court and federal court, and then my 5 years as a defense attorney, I've seen plenty of crocodile tears, Rick, plenty of situations where I felt the person was trying to gin up some emotion or manufacture some sympathy. And what I saw was an 18-year-old kid who is living a bit of a nightmare. And I think when he had his emotional outburst, that was about as genuine as it gets. I actually think that even though it's not substantive testimony when something like that happens, the atmospherics were exactly right for that jury to remember that this is a kid. And he's been called a terrorist and a racist. He was arrested 48 hours after the event, which I think is worthy of a lot of condemnation. And no matter what, best case, he has to live with shooting and killing a human being. I mean, these are not easy things. And as we heard yesterday, he's being treated for post-traumatic stress disorder, which, again, wasn't part of a legal defense. It's just real life.
So after watching Kyle Rittenhouse on the stand, from your perspective, do you think it was the right move?
Yeah, I do. I mean, most of the time, yeah, it's funny, when the government's case, the prosecutor's case is not that good, and I've lived this, sometimes a weak defense is the saving grace, that all of a sudden the prosecution makes their case because the defense makes the mistake of over-trying the case instead of just sitting pretty and resting and saying it was insufficient evidence. Here, I think the jury in a self-defense case really does want to hear from the defendant. And I think in this particular case, assessing whether he was legitimately, reasonably fearful of these men that came after him, that it was a good tactic and a good move to have him testify.
A number of the experts who have been commenting on the trial have brought up the idea that the prosecution's case was going so poorly that they are intentionally trying to have the judge declare a mistrial, which is why the prosecutor has done some of the things he's done that have really irritated the judge. What's your take on that angle?
Yeah, that's a little bit too much of a conspiracy theory for me in this particular case. But the starting point is this. The prosecution in this case knew from a prior order of the court that they were not supposed to wade into this very dangerous territory of commenting on a defendant's right to silence. In other words, if a defendant doesn't give a statement to law enforcement at the time of arrest, for instance, that's not something you can touch on in front of the jury because it implicates your Fifth Amendment rights. It's a real third rail. And here, the prosecutor, despite that ruling, waded right back into that, setting off this judge and raising a motion for a mistrial. Now, the problem with the intentional theory is that if the government spurred a mistrial, there's a decent chance that the judge would rule that it was the type of error that doesn't allow for retrial. So you would lose on that motion based on prejudice. They would say this was intentional conduct. It was not the type of thing that we can allow a retrial to take place on, and the whole case is gone. But I think there's an interesting possibility of what's going on here, which is the judge has not ruled on that motion for a mistrial. He's kind of keeping it in his hip pocket. And you have to back up and recognize most judges don't want to be seen as kind of the all-powerful 13th juror. They don't want to be the ones that decide a case that's in front of a jury unless they really have to. And I think what's happening here is the judge might be taking a wait-and-see approach. He may have strong feelings about Kyle being innocent of some of the most serious charges, but he's going to let the jury do their job first. And if he disagrees with the verdict, then he could still turn around and deal with that Fifth Amendment violation, but in the context of granting a new trial, because that's the type of motion the defense would file after a conviction. So the prosecution's not out of the woods for having really botched this thing when it comes to that Fifth Amendment right. I'm reading into it a little bit of Machiavellian notions on behalf of the judge, but it wouldn't shock me since he hasn't ruled on the motion formally.
So what's the next step?
Well, closing arguments. And it'll be interesting. You know, I think a lot of times when cases are highly publicized and highly career building, for lack of a better phrase, for either prosecutors or defense attorneys, they tend to overdo their closing arguments. They want to cover every bit of evidence, and they ask the judge for 6 hours, and they're happy when they get 5 hours. But jurors don't really want that. I mean, and this is a tricky case, and there's some very tricky legal instructions about self-defense and how the burden shifts to the government to disprove self-defense. But I don't think it's the type of thing where a jury really wants to be stuck there for a 12-hour day of argument. But I also predict they will. I think that's probably where it's going to go, and then we'll get some deliberation starting either late Monday or more likely on Tuesday.
And I'm sure we'll be talking about the takeaways after the verdict is in. But as it stands now, what would you say key takeaways are?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, the starting point for me is that when prosecutors rush to judgment in any case, no matter what the ultimate verdict, it's a bad idea. And I think in this case, it was really less than 48 hours after the events on the streets of Kenosha that the district attorney had filed this indictment. And to me, it seemed clearly responsive to the shouts of the mob, and I include the mainstream media in that mob, that Kyle was some sort of racist murderer that had to be, you know, put down as a symbol of white racism and violence. And you know, that's just not a good recipe for judgment. And it really, frankly, reminds me of the Duke LaCrosse case from years ago where Mike Nafong, the district attorney in Durham, rushed the judgment for political purposes. He had this very high-profile cross-racial issue of whether the Duke lacrosse team had raped an African-American woman. And as he sat on the cusp of a campaign for DA, he made the decision to charge these young men, although he knew at the time that the evidence was actually insufficient. So I'm not saying it's quite as dramatic as that scenario was down in North Carolina, but again, the fact that these DAs rushed to judgment within 48 hours is just not what we should want from our system. We should want them to have the independence and judgment to investigate these matters for a while before they actually make charging decisions. And then, Rick, the only other thing I'd say is I think this case in a lot of ways comes down to the notion of jury selection, what type of personalities they have there. There's a lot of jurors in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in the Midwest that aren't quite as hung up on the notion of a young man taking an AR-15 with him when he goes downtown that night. Of course, on the other side of the equation, you've got plenty of urban dwellers and folks on the East Coast that can't really get past that initial decision by him. They think, well, Kyle used bad judgment to go down there in the first place, and that might be enough for them to want to convict just because of the bad judgment. So I think that's what it's going to come down to in some ways is the personal philosophies of the jurors and whether they're going to focus on the overall decision-making or the specific moments when the shootings took place, which is what the law would ask them to do.
And depending on the outcome, and this is something we'll go into detail possibly next weekend, we saw Nick Sandman, one of the Covington Catholic students here in Washington, and he had a defamation case against the Washington Post for $250 million. It was settled. Not sure what the outcome was, except that he did win a settlement there. With everything you've seen in the media, all the way up to presidential candidate Joe Biden calling Kyle Rittenhouse a white supremacist during the campaign, if he is found innocent, does he have grounds to start seeking compensation for defamation?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing that, you know, these high-profile, highly hyperbolic moments where everyone has an opinion about some young man's guilt, that's the type of stuff where there should be compensation if he's actually not guilty. And I would just back up and mention, you mentioned Joe Biden's comments. I don't really care who it is, whether it's Joe Biden, Donald Trump, Obama, when he's talking about his friend getting a disorderly conduct ticket. Presidents of the United States should not be weighing in on criminal cases, particularly as the cases are pending. I suppose it's one thing to comment after the fact, but they should be concerned about one thing, which is due process and fair trials. And Biden certainly didn't pull that off when it came to Kyle Rittenhouse.
Jim, we'll be following your analysis on the Fox News channel as well as on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. Jim Trusty, IFRA Law, thank you so much.
Sure, thanks. Have a good weekend.
7 o'clock news next on WMAL, then John Gizzi, Cheryl Atkinson, Tony Schaefer, and KT McFarland.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. The one radio station for you to depend on. All day, every day. 105.9 FM, WMAL, a Cumulus Media station.